Still, Queer As Folk. Tonight, Justin gets a nipple pierced. And an angry parent attacks Brian. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Smells Like Codependence.
It first aired on Showtime in the U.S. on January 28th, 2001.
It was directed by David Wellington and written by Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman.
We actually have a couple of synopses here. IMDb describes the episode as Debbie meets Dr. David. Michael and Dr. David spend a weekend in the country.
Ooh, can't wait for that scene.
Excuse me, I'm just going to take a quick sip of my Chardonnay thinking of that scene.
There were horses involved.
Justin's father learns the truth and decides to send Justin away to school. Brian's emotional hold on Michael and dislike for Dr. David intensifies. Or we could go with Showtime, which decides to just cut out anything that involves Michael or Debbie or Dr. David. Justin's father learns that he's gay and forbids him to see Brian while Brian continues to stew over Michael's new relationship. After Justin's father tries to run Brian off the road, he decides to send his son away to school. Showtime is more succinct, but I will say, spoiler alert, geez.
Yeah.
Just gives away a whole thing. Okay.
I think that a lot of the Showtime synopsis were like for TV Guide, and so they were trying to really hook people in, and this one just doesn't really do that other than Justin's father tries to run him off the road.
You can hear the dun-dun-dun.
It's like a 1970s sitcom. This episode had a pretty interesting theme that I picked up on, and that was replacement. And there's a sub-theme that drove that, which is jealousy. So we see Justin pulling away from his dad, replacing his dad with Brian. We see Michael pulling away from Brian, replacing him with Dr. David. And that was something that kept coming clear throughout the entire episode. The Brian and Justin dynamic in this episode was kind of strange.
Completely.
I think Brian was in rare form in this episode. You know, first he's dismissive of Justin at Woody's, and then he's fucking him. Then he's back in the loft with the entire gang as if he's just kind of like a full-fledged member and they all love him at this point.
He is such a pissant in this episode. Like, he infuriated me. And obviously it has to do with, you know, Dr. David Cameron being a
your hero.
Blessed.
Did you go to the chiropractor since last week?
No, I still have to make my appointment to be coddled and snapped back into place by Dr. David
Molested
Cameron.
Molested is another word for it. Adjusted?
That maybe entire thing way. Was consensual, so I will not say he was molested.
Michael never consented to that. He just flipped over.
That was him consenting. That was him saying, I am open for business.
That's all it takes. Last week you said that he's open and cleaned out and ready for business.
And I stand by that statement. So we open this episode with Justin and Daphne walking into some tattoo parlor. Again, remember, Justin is still only 17, so I feel like he couldn't have gotten in there unless there were different laws enacted. But here he is in this tattoo parlor to get a piercing.
Liberty Avenue has it all.
They also have very loose definitions on consent. So...
Yeah, so far we've never even seen Justin denied from entering a bar.
No.
It's always just sort of implied that he has a fake ID and he bought one at some point, but they just wave him right in. Come on, little twink, walk right in.
Nobody questions a thing.
When he walks into the piercing salon, he was almost trying to be Brian.
I mean, just because he's your boyfriend.
He's not my boyfriend. I don't do boyfriends.
That was something new with Justin. In the past, he had always been pining for Brian, but now he's like taking on some of Brian's aura and trying to act the same way.
No, there are moments in earlier episodes where he tries to be very nonchalant about his attraction to Brian. But then, of course, you know, as the episode progresses, we see him with Brian, like he latches onto him. And it's like, Justin, we see through your facade.
We also got to see a very pornographic close-up of Justin's nipple in this scene right before he gets pierced.
And I love with the woman who's doing the piercing, because he has, you know, is it going to hurt? And she's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And then a very well-placed sound effect. I believe the actual piercing happening.
A little crunch.
Well, based on Justin's facial reaction, he seemed very into it. So
he did. Ow!
So yeah, we have this piercing moment.
Let's talk about that for a minute. What do you think the significance of Justin getting pierced was? Was it just a little bit of eye candy, or is this some sort of thing that all gay men at age 17 do when they come out in Pittsburgh?
I don't know if he just like saw it at a club, or he saw it in maybe someone that Brian was attracted to, so he's just trying to emulate that. Because he makes it seem, when he meets Brian later on at Woody's, the first thing he wants to do is show him. The first thing is like, guess what I did?
Yeah.
And he lifts his shirt and like does this whole slow reveal. It's like, okay, so you obviously did this for a guy.
It seemed like just kind of a filler scene. It was something for them to do while they had some dialogue to deliver. And I think we see that pierced nipple maybe two or three times more in this episode. And then it's never really mentioned again.
He just has it.
Yeah.
So we go from the piercing to Michael and Dr. David Cameron having dinner at the diner.
Your dream event.
Dr. David Cameron can do no wrong right now. He and I love this. So like, there's this short voiceover by Michael about having a boyfriend. Like, we always like say like that's our goal, to have a boyfriend, and that's all we're looking for. And then he's like, but in reality, we all know that that's bullshit, because, you know, he basically makes some sort of comparison about like, we could barely, you know, be committed to something, and why would we ever commit to another man? And I'm like, it's very true, Michael. Your entire behavior when you first met Dr. David Cameron speaks to that. When Dr. David Cameron was ready to have you, you know, wait to have sex, you go and get blown by some anonymous stranger in the back room of Babylon because you just can't handle the fact that someone didn't want to be physical with you.
Do you think that the whole boyfriend thing that Michael was talking about is still relevant? Do you think that that's the driving force of everybody at Michael's stage in life, late 20s, kind of about to turn 30? Or it to me, it seems like just kind of a series of really short-term boyfriends where you just kind of hang out and see if you get sentimental on New Year's Eve with each other.
I think you're much more cynical about relationships than I am, Patrick.
Surprise.
Because, well, I mean, that's definitely what I'm more interested in, is, you know,
the boyfriend experience.
Finding someone to eventually spend a good chunk of my life or my entire life with.
What a hassle.
I am a traditionalist in that sense, I will say. So I get it, you know. Then there's also just like the primal urges, you know, and I think that's what Michael is alluding to when he's talking about being with Dr. David Cameron.
Everybody's always wishing they had a boyfriend. We all picture how he'd look, how he'd sound, how nice it'd be to have someone to share your life, your dreams, your dental floss. So how come so few of us have one? That's because we're lying. Most of us couldn't commit to a house plan. How are we supposed to commit to having a boyfriend?
I think some of the technology these days doesn't really lend itself towards developing a relationship. You have
100%.
You have the hookup apps. There's, I don't know, a half dozen of those. And then you have like the relationship app of Tinder, which a lot of people...
Or Bumble.
Bumble. A lot of people treat it the same way, though, as they're just looking for that hookup. I just found it interesting that in 2000... when this was airing, 2001, when this was airing, that it was the boyfriend experience. And it just doesn't seem that way nowadays. Everybody just seems so kind of short, to the point, and that's it.
I don't know. I mean, I have so many friends, gay and straight, who are getting married at my age or are now married. And I'm like, I often wonder, I'm like, am I doing something wrong? Am I like just literally not meeting the right guy? Or,
leave a note in the comments if you'd like to meet Matt. We can arrange that.
I think Patrick's my pimp now. So they're having this, back to the show.
Yeah. Whoops.
So Michael and Dr. David Cameron are having this dinner at the diner, and Debbie comes over, makes a lewd comment about, I think, eating onion, especially if they want to go at it all night. And this is where Dr. David Cameron meets Debbie and finds out that this is Michael's mother.
Was this before or after Dr. David said he wanted to eat Michael like a dessert?
And you've got to stop smiling like that.
What?
Like that. It makes me want to come across the table and eat you like a dessert.
This was literally right before. Because that's what it's. Her comment is what was on the heels of Dr. David Cameron saying he was ready to eat Michael like a dessert.
I think the writers could have done better with that line.
I think it gets the point across.
yeah. This was another awkward introduction to Debbie. Everybody's had one. Justin had his, and now Dr. David has his, where they're in the diner. Debbie is kind of the jester of the diner, and then it's like, oh, thanks, Mom. And it was a little predictable there. The scene was recycled.
But I will say, I think Sharon Gless uses her usual charm, as she does with Debbie, to win Dr. David Cameron over. She is adamant that she thinks he's a hunk of... gorgeous, and is like, you are going to come over for dinner. And before Michael tries to deflect the situation, Dr. David Cameron is saying, yes, I will do that. And
yeah, the grown up in the group there.
Right. And, he even helps give Debbie some advice when she's trying to do some more, when she's trying to bust another table in terms of lifting. And so this is where she finds out that he is a doctor.
Yeah.
And she goes into like super mom mode where she's like, how long are you going to hide him from me? And it's like,
as long as possible.
You're dating a doctor? How long are you planning on hiding him from me?
As long as I could.
It's like, that's the dream. That's the mom's dream. Her son to
I thought
with a
far more
handsome doctor.
Far more interesting than Dr. David Cameron meeting Debbie was us getting to meet Justin's father, Craig Taylor. Till now, we only heard him yelling in the background, right? The time that Debbie showed up on the porch.
Oh, yes. He had that one line, like, who is this or who is it? And it's because Jennifer has now basically come clean about Justin. And Craig doesn't believe it for a second. He thinks, much like how Jennifer was in their therapy session, he's 17. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know what he wants. How does he know? And she's very upfront. Like I caught him in a gay bar. And
yeah, Craig Taylor was right out of central casting for sort of the abusive, gay, non-accepting father. He's just gotten home from work, so he still has his part of his suit on, and he has his tie loosened, the top button undone. He's got a whiskey, so he's carrying around a glass the whole time.
Whiskey neat.
Yeah. And he's just comes across as this typical alcoholic, and the anger and the rage is coming through all the time. He had these funny lines where he's trying to pawn off Justin's behavior as something other than it was. So he says, oh, well, he's drawing naked men as part of an art project in high school. And that he buys thongs for himself.
Right. And Jennifer's retort is great. They're not his size. Yeah.
Which is kind of funny because I think Brian and Justin probably do wear the same size underwear. Another great scene from Sherry Miller here, though. Jennifer Taylor
continues to develop into one of my favorite characters in this show. Like the way she fiercely protects Justin, tries to understand him, and then, and she comes from a good place of telling Craig about Justin.
She was very confident and kind of put together with it. She'd thought it through and she was ready to break the news.
He's not confused. He's not scared. He knows. Same way we've always known.
No, I have not always known.
At least suspected.
No, you've suspected. He's not gay. He's...
What? Sensitive? Different? Artistic?
He's his own person.
She's very much a straight shooter.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive the phrase. But you need to talk to him and try and understand him before he does God knows what, or exposes himself to God knows what, if he hasn't already, which that just turns the crank on Craig.
Yeah. It was great the way that Jennifer Taylor introduces Brian.
There's more. He's seeing someone.
So who is this kid? I'll call his parents.
He's not a kid. He's a man. His name is Brian Kinney.
It's not a kid. He's a man. And I'm like, ooh.
His name is Brian Kinney. As if like Craig Taylor is going to know who Brian Kinney is at that point.
Right. It's like, what?
Meanwhile, of course, everybody is hanging out at Woody's.
You know, I like Woody's a lot more than I like Babylon, so I like it when they spend time in Woody's.
Woody's plays such great music. I like that just kind of down tempo, a little bit happy, but not over the top with a lot of horns in it or anything like that.
No, it's not overbearing. That's why I like it.
Yeah, good hangout bar.
Yeah. And Ted and Emmett are ribbing Michael about this budding relationship that Michael has with Dr. David Cameron.
Yeah. Ted was just digging at the whole thing where he had that line, the commitment ceremony where all 200 of the guests have slept with one, if not both, of the happy couple. I have been to a wedding like that before.
Me too. I was at a gay wedding where I was like, I know the sexual history of so many people in this room right now.
Had you hooked up with the grooms individually or together?
One of them.
There it is. Ted speaks the truth. He did come out of a coma, so maybe he picked up some of this while he was...
He went full dead zone when he was in his coma.
Did you see how catty Brian was to Justin when he showed up?
How could you not?
Guess what I got today? A new bell for your bicycle. A nipple ring. Every piece of trash has something stuck through their ear or their nose or their belly button, their cock. What makes you think I'm even remotely interested that you have a ring through your tip?
Well, I don't get Brian's on again, off again, antagonistic behavior towards Justin.
Well, I think in this instance, he was just fired up of all this conversation that Michael has, or all the conversation.
You're
about
always
Dr.
apologizing
David
for Brian.
I'm not apologizing for Brian. Blake's out of the picture from now on. But no, what's going on with Brian is he's lashing out because of this discussion of Michael and Dr. David Cameron being a couple, you know, the jokes about them getting married. I mean, this is I think Michael's been the emotional core for Brian. And to see it possibly being snatched away by someone else.
I just think Brian's a moody little cunt. That's all.
I mean, I'm not going to argue that either.
Because after he was offhand towards him when he first shows up, he takes him home and bangs him at the same time that we see Craig Taylor rummaging through Justin's room.
As if he had never been in Justin's room ever. Yeah. And it's like as if he just discovered he has a kid named Justin. You know, he walks in there and he's like, it's a scene like a kid he doesn't recognize. And then this whole scene, the way they intercut him finding a magazine in Justin's room or looking at the drawings that he has on the wall. Justin is getting pounded by Brian.
That was a very well shot scene.
Yeah, well, and it was also very well edited because it also harkened back to the scene where Jennifer plays out like the fantasy in the art gallery where we see, you know, because she sees Brian put his arm around Justin and then her mind distorts it to something a lot more sexual, you know, Brian taking Justin right there on the piano. But here we're seeing like the real thing.
Yeah. The nice blue lighting that was going on and gripping the sheets.
But Craig looking utterly defeated and as it fades out on him. But
did you see that cute little prop that Craig came across while he's searching? There's this picture of Brian and Justin together, and Brian's got his arms around Justin. They're both like smiling very broadly. I thought that prop was a little self-serving for the scene. I'm not sure when they would have taken that picture because...
And I doubt Brian would ever be that happy Justin, like at least given the timeline that we're working with.
I like the picture because it had kind of that idealized version of Brian and Justin, because we're kind of on Justin's side. We're rooting for him. Right. We want to see that relationship happen. And there we see a picture of it. But I don't think that picture would have existed. I don't think Brian would have posed for a picture like that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just going to say, yeah, I agree. I have nothing else to add because I can't even tell you when there would have been the opportune time for a picture like that to have been taken.
Yeah.
It's almost as if...
Who is the photographer in all these?
Right. Who's developing these?
Right.
You know?
Meanwhile, our favorite word, meanwhile, Michael's getting ready to take Dr. David to his mother's house when Brian shows up. And I loved how catty Emmett was with Brian.
That must be Prince Charming.
Make that the Wicked Witch.
It made me so happy. Called him the Wicked Witch when he entered.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, read the bitch.
Yeah. And it's, Dr. David Cameron comes in with flowers and...
Right. Well, it's like, because that scene in Woody's, they were going through like this checklist. They're like, this is how you know he's your boyfriend. You know, he's going to give you flowers for no reason. He's going to invite you to the country for the weekend. Or the telltale sign, he meets your mother and you're going to go over her house for dinner, which freaks Michael out because right. That's exactly what's happening. So it's like he's hitting the checklist very on the nose.
Well, and he went beyond the nose because not only did he bring flowers for Michael, he brought them for his mother.
Dr. David Cameron is trying to show that the perfect man can exist. I think that's very clear.
Have you ever brought flowers to somebody on a date?
Not on a date. Flowers have been bought for me.
Oh.
Yeah.
I tried that once, and his name was Curtis, and he never showed up.
Oh my God.
And I was commiserating afterwards with one of my friends, and he says, Patrick, you're an idiot. You only bring flowers for funerals. Since then, I've just been entirely allergic to the notion of bringing somebody flowers.
It was really funny because it was on Valentine's Day, and it was with a former boyfriend who was very honest with me. He's like, I don't really believe in Valentine's Day.
But here are some flowers,
here are some chocolates, and here's a really nice card. And I'm like, well, you might not believe in it, but you're nailing it right now, dude.
Yeah, you can stay.
Nathan can stay.
The funny thing about Michael and Dr. David Cameron is, this is their third date. They aren't even boyfriends yet. And there was so much spin up to the whole boyfriend moment. And maybe they're seeing each other.
Three.
Yeah, maybe they're seeing each other outside of the continuum that we're seeing. But this was something in the episode that I kept coming back to, is they really had the gas pedal all the way down on accelerating this relationship. And it was good to make the story move forward. But at the same time, they really could have stretched out Dr. David a lot longer, I think.
Well, Dr. David Cameron was stretching out Michael.
Oh.
So. The series is just trying to catch up.
That's what happens when you bring flowers, right?
Oh, we have to talk about... So Michael had purchased some chocolate eclairs.
I forgot about this.
Some chocolate eclairs. And when, you know, Brian shows up and, you know, tries to command the room. He opens the box immediately. What's this? And before Michael can finish saying what it is, Brian has downed the entire eclair. What would you say? Like 8 inches worth?
Oh, yeah.
Just completely down his throat.
I wonder how many takes that took.
Poor Gale Harold. Gale Harold, he opened up and just took it.
Well, first of all, he's straight also. So that was some great method acting on his part to really embrace the role.
Wow. I mean, Emmett says it best. It takes years to develop technique like that.
Wow, it takes years of practice to develop technique like that.
Another Caddy Emmett moment that I loved in that scene.
Oh, yeah, he was crushing it.
So those two take off to head to Debbie's house.
To meet Debbie and Vic.
Justin's getting the business from Craig and Jennifer. This scene was... Oh. I thought really well written and acted, though. Yes. Craig Taylor was a little bit over the top, but
I think they're trying to show a very sharp contrast, but it's to the point where it's a little extreme.
Yeah.
Of how Craig is handling the news compared to how Jennifer has handled the news. And, you know, and Justin is like, yes, he has the father, you know, dealing with, the news that he's gay, but he's more concerned about the betrayal he feels from Jennifer for telling his father, which is totally fair. You know, he thinks he can finally confide in her in some way.
She did promise not to tell him.
Right.
A couple times on the way to Nike Town.
Nike Town. Remember when it was so simple? It was just about lying to go to Nike Town.
Oh, yeah.
but you understand Jennifer's, her logic. I had to tell him because it is not right for a man of Brian's age to be with a boy of your age.
Yeah, I think she said touching you.
Touching
something
you.
Like kind of creepy. So,
well, I mean, if you look at it objectively, it is creepy.
It's not right for a man his age to be touching you, to be having sex with you.
Yeah, he may be 17. That's still illegal.
Was this the scene where One of them says, "What about AIDS or something like that?"
Yes, I even have that down. I was like, "Yeah," because and I like because Jennifer is trying. She's like, "It's not right for you to be with him, but not for the reason you think." Mm-hmm. You know, it's not right for a man that age to be touching you and whatever. And Craig says, "What about AIDS?" And I'm like, "His ignorance is so obvious and blatant."
Well, it was 2000, so
even then, it's still
straight fathers might have had a very different mindset at the time.
Still an idiot.
I did like the line where Justin says, "He wore a condom. I put it on myself."
Oh, you could just see that attaboy, knife Justin. Just digging into Craig yeah. and twisting.
Every time Justin would say something like even remotely sexual, Craig is just kind of like, "Ah!"
"What about AIDS?"
"He wore a condom. I put it on myself."
"Oh, God! I'm calling the police."
Right? He can't fathom the idea. It's not that his son is sexual, it's that his son is sexual with a man.
Yeah. There's a really quick shot where Jennifer and Craig are bickering back and forth, and Justin's right in the middle, and you can see him rolling his eyes and laughing at how obnoxious they were being about it. And I don't know if Randy Harrison just kind of cracked at that moment or whether it was really part of the script. It was very subtle, and you had to look for it, but he almost realized that his parents were being ridiculous and he was kind of done with their antics for the moment.
Right. I mean, I was absolutely done. I wanted to punch Craig for all of his ignorant comments that he was making, which, I mean, you know, maybe in 2000, the people might have related to that in some way, but also, oh my, it was just so blaringly and woefully wrong.
Yeah.
That just made my blood boil. In
happier times, though, dinner at Debbie's, and this was another quick scene. Vic has a couple little stingers in there. The funny thing that I found in this scene was how that Lady and the Tramp thing that they played out, where they're pulling the noodle together.
Who does that in front of their mother?
First of all, who kisses with your mouth full?
Yeah, you know, if you're going to have this cutesy moment, that's fine. I get it. But in front of your mother and your uncle, like,
yeah,
no.
Well, and then it's like one kiss and they had to fuck. They had to go upstairs and fuck. This is their first time.
Their chemistry is so electric.
Yeah. Third date after your hero, Dr. David Cameron, is saying, "I want to get to know you before I fuck you." And here they are. Three dates.
Hey.
Three on the third date, Dr. David Cameron.
On the third date with Dr. David Cameron.
He meets Michael's mother. He goes to Michael's boyhood bedroom and bangs him and then invites him to the woods.
Right. And remember, Debbie said, "If you don't say yes, I'm going to disown you." So he had to say yes.
"Say yes, you little asshole, or I'll disown you."
I don't know. This Dr. David Cameron sounds like bad news to me. Run away, Michael.
Run into his arms. Run into his arms, Michael.
What's Brian up to right about now?
Oh, well, Brian is in his loft, and he looks like he's on some sort of website.
Oh, I love those
chat room
2000 era gay sites with the terrible graphics. They look so dated.
Awful. I'm like, is he on AOL dial-up? I wonder how long it takes for that conversation to load. Well, Brian gets a call, doesn't even ask, "Hello, who is it?" He just immediately says his address. And another sexual comment, and leaves it at that. And I'm like,
doesn't he have caller ID? This is 2000. Caller ID was like 20 years old by that point.
He
doesn't even look at it.
He literally just answered the phone, said lewd things, and moved on. Then he's greeted at the door by Michael, who has the wonderful news that he's going away for the weekend and cannot go to the event at Babylon for that weekend. Studs in Suds.
Michael went out of his way to like go over to Brian's loft. He couldn't have phoned.
Oh, no.
He had to go all the way over there.
Going away for the weekend in the country with your, I can't really say boyfriend, but your man friend.
Your top.
Your dick. of 3 dates requires an in-person meeting.
Would you go?
Away for the weekend?
I would, yeah.
Oh,
I would go.
Oh, hell yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. Hi. I'm an extremely attractive doctor who would like to take you away to my cabin for the weekend.
Yeah, jump in my Jaguar and let's go.
I'm done.
I did like how Brian was getting jealous over Michael being invited to the country. And it was really a plot element there because he has really got no reason to be jealous. He's never shown any interest in doing anything with Michael that he's, you know, not already at. So it was just kind of a tension building moment, but it worked in the scene just to establish what's to come later in the scene.
Yes. And the phone rings again, and Michael explains that he has a new dildo, another massive dildo.
Brian.
Brian.
Michael has Dr. David.
Michael has Dr. David Cameron, who's going to be his dildo.
He's equally as sizable.
I would agree with that statement. We'll have an underwear check, I think, in the next episode when it comes to Dr. David Cameron. I'm very much looking forward to it. He answers the phone again and tells this caller what he's going to do with this massive dildo that he has.
I've got this new dildo, 9 inches long, 7 inches round. I'm going to open up your hole with it, and then I'm going to fuck you so hard your eyes roll back in your head.
I love what Michael says. You ever considered sales?
I'm like, yeah.
Right? Have you ever considered phone sales? I'm like...
Well, and then it cut to this sinister music, and there's this big overhead shot of Craig Taylor in the darkened two-story foyer, yes, of the Taylor family home.
So noirish.
Yeah, and he's building up the tension, and he's starting to simmer on it, and you get a little sense that this guy's about to snap and do something crazy.
Well, when someone answers the phone with, "Hi, I have a dildo that's going to open your hole and that he's going to fuck you so hard."
I mean, does Brian really do that? I don't think he does. I don't think Brian does that whole dildo play thing.
Well, apparently he was planning on it with whoever was coming over. How did he describe him? 10 inches of fun? I'm like, who is...
There's something that's not quite driving here.
No.
Just doesn't match up. But Michael, I think it's maybe later in the evening, or time kind of jumped around in this episode. I'm not sure if it's the next day or if Michael went straight home, but he's packing to leave. And suddenly Ted has all the answers, where Ted previously has always been the schlub who never has any of the answers. Now he's got all the answers.
And the coma did him good. Yeah.
Emmett, I don't know if you saw it, but Emmett actually groped Ted in this scene. He reached down and grabbed him.
Ted's newfound confidence, I think, did something for Emmett. But yeah, Michael is packing, and he packs away 4 pairs of jeans, 6 shirts, sweaters, and 10 tees.
Yeah.
And Ted just comes over without missing him. He goes, pair of undies, packet of condoms, tube of lube, you're good to go.
Tube of lube.
A tube.
And we see, once again, we see KY lube just landing there in Michael's suitcase. It's like, this is not your grandmother's lube.
No.
Or maybe it is, actually. There was a little interstitial scene with Brian and Lindsay that cut in here where she's warning Brian about not fucking it up for Michael. And she knows Brian pretty well and knows him enough to say that, but this scene just was, once again, just sort of shoehorned right into the middle of it.
Again, just trying to sort of make sure that Mel and or Lindsay show up in this episode.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But if anyone's going to say it to defend Michael, I like that it's Lindsay, because she might be the one of the few people who could, besides Michael, I feel like it's Michael and Lindsay that could in some way crack into Brian to maybe not be a total dick.
Justin, we find in the locker room.
One of his favorite places.
And he's taking a little heat from Chris Hobbs. Did you notice that Justin has a hell of a right hook? Just one punch and he takes Chris Hobbs to the ground.
Before we get into the locker room fight, here's where the nipple ring comes into play again.
Oh, right.
Chris Hobbs sees this and he's like, "What the fuck is that?" And he's like, "It's a nipple ring I got on, you know, from the a place on Liberty Avenue. And he's like, wow, you really are queer. And then Justin says, no, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
So like he tries to hide it again.
I got this in the gayborhood. No, I'm not gay.
Right. I got my nipple pierced in the gayborhood tattoo piercing parlor. But I am not a homosexual, even though you know I am because I totally gave you a handy when we were cleaning out the... Like, I mean, it's a fascinating scene to watch play out.
Then all of a sudden, Justin is spitting enough blood on him to be sort of like that scene in Downton Abbey.
Oh, my God, right? For those who have not seen, what, season 6 of Downton Abbey?
Five or six, yeah.
You'll find out soon enough what that means. But yeah, he spits the blood at Chris Hobbs, which, you know, I'm sure Chris Hobbs had, you know, the antiquated notion of HIV AIDS and flips the fuck out because he has blood in his mouth. So it's like, then again, Justin is having sex with a lot of anonymous people in bathrooms. So maybe he was justified in freaking out.
On to happier things. The pastoral serenity of Dr. David Cameron's cabin in the woods, complete with horses prancing around in a pen.
It's almost like a dream.
Who cares for those horses?
I'm sure he has hired hands.
He's a stable boy.
A la Brokeback Mountain.
This started to get a little silly when he's talking about he built the place himself. This is like a two-story like log cabin that the chiropractor apparently built himself.
He's a man.
With his wife.
Oh, yes. It is revealed the past life of Dr. David Cameron. He was married to a woman for 7 years and has a 12-year-old son who lives with her in Oregon.
Why does he have a picture of his ex-wife on the mantle in the cabin?
Maybe they're still on good terms. Maybe? Yeah. I don't know.
Well, no, he said that he doesn't really talk to her anymore after she moved away and took the kid. So it was just a little out of place. It was a prop that was in there for Michael
Was it just his wife or was it the wife and the son?
I think there's two pictures. The first one was just his wife and then the other one was maybe the three of them. But it was just there for Michael to notice and go, oh, what's this all about?
Who's this?
My ex.
Ex-scuba diving instructor, ex-figure skating partner.
Ex-wife.
Michael's really learning a lot about Dr. David here, which is a funny place for that to happen, where heretofore on their third date, this is their fourth date, they show up at the cabin and then Michael's like, oh, you're married. Oh, you built this by yourself. Oh, you have a kid. I don't think that's the time and place to like find out that type of thing.
The kid thing, especially, I would have been like, whoa. Okay, we have a lot to ground to cover, and we got a lot to talk about this weekend.
Well, it got a little crazier when Dr. David starts saying that he's in love with Michael.
Fourth date,
and then Michael faints. They're like hugging, and Michael's all like, all warmed up into him. It's like, dude, fourth date, calm down, both of you, take it easy.
But. And then, of course, we're back in the city, and it's time for studs and suds.
Have you ever been to anything like that? I have.
Who in Chicago used to do that? Was it Spin, or does Charlie's do it?
I don't know who did it here. I went to one in London, of course. And let me say, it's probably the last thing that I'll ever do again.
None for me, thank you.
I think Ted sums it up correctly when he's just tearing the whole evening apart. Taking his digs at Brian, and
he was like the righteous against Brian in this scene, and I was living for every moment of it.
There's a certain amount of inconsistency with these characters that we're seeing in this episode, and it was written by the showrunners and the creators of the US version, so it kind of felt like a lot of this stuff was a little out of order in terms of the storyline. We had other writers for the last couple of episodes. And so we had like the comedy episode that we saw. Yeah. And then we had the 30 something episode with the three moms. And now this episode was a little strange to me.
It's very slashed together.
Yeah. You know? It was like a bunch of extra takes that they just cut together into an episode.
Episode 7.
Right.
But no, I love Ted. Just shutting Brian down. Mm-hmm. Like, he's like,
You always seem to enjoy yourself when Michael's here. But I guess it's not as much fun scoring without your little audience of one, is it? You know, as the great French philosopher Roquefort, or what was it, Camembert, once said, it is not enough to trick. Your best friend must also go home alone.
Fuck you.
Tearing into him about how he uses Michael, and he sees right through the jealousy that he feels, and it's fantastic. It's so much so that Ted is able to make Brian leave Babylon.
Ted found his balls.
It was amazing. I was like, all of a sudden, here I am going, I'm slightly attracted to you, Ted.
And then there's that trick that was outside that.
This anonymous trick.
Yeah. Remember this guy me? Got crazy. And he like is beating up the car, the Jeep. It's like, let's take a swing at the Jeep.
Right. He's like, who the fuck are you? And I'm like,
I am so pissed at you. I'm going to attack your car.
Right. Like, what? And where did he hook up with Brian? At some, like some
at
other
the baths.
Oh, at the baths. You're not going to find your one true love at the baths, dude.
You never know.
Imagine that.
Hypothetically.
Story. Imagine that story to your grandchildren.
Yeah. Where did you meet? Well, in the dry sauna.
It was Steamworks room 217. And
Brian drives away, and he drives. I don't know where Brian lives in relation to Babylon, but he's out in the country all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's like by a park or something like that.
There's like a barn in the background.
Yeah, and he's trying to check the tape, the cassette tape.
You're right. He's holding up different tapes. He's
trying to find the cassette tape to play.
I don't think they had any budget at this point. They just had to find an intersection someplace that didn't have anything behind it. They could just really easily light it and then bash the cars and then get out of there without having a permit.
So while Brian is at the light, this car comes in and just rams into him. The car backs up and then sideswipes him and leaves Brian there. We're left to think like it's got to be the angry trick.
We don't really know what happens after that. This could have been a cliffhanger in and of itself if they just ended it right there with Brian slumped over the steering wheel.
Right. They could have been like, next time on Queer as Folk.
Or leave him slumped over the steering wheel while we see Michael and Dr. David outside in the next day.
Making with their picnic. Love under a tree.
Oh, outdoors. Those mosquitoes and bugs.
They don't seem bothered.
Poison ivy.
I believe Dr. David Cameron would be knowledgeable enough to clock whether it might be poison ivy. Plus, they have a blanket laid out.
But then he comes across as, like, sugar daddy. He just whips that out all of a sudden and says,
there's a whole world outside Liberty Avenue. I'd like to show it to you if you'd let me.
He's grooming him. It's not a sugar daddy thing. He's saying like there's more to gay life than the scene.
But then he's saying, let me show it to you.
In the back room of Babylon. So I am...
Your Dr. David is looking very flawed in this scene. And then he runs off naked through the woods.
Oh, God.
He like jumped up and like swung off of that tree.
Like it's like Tarzan. It's like a kid in love. I loved it. I thought it was really great. And of course, the first thing Michael has to do is call Brian.
Rubbing pink stuff all over the poison ivy you got when that bear chased you through the woods.
Basking in the afterglow of having just made love to David under a tree, asshole.
Did you notice when he's calling Brian, they've got him laying face down up on his elbows, and so he just has his big bubble butt just pointing right up at the sky.
Oh, yeah.
Hal Sparks, where'd that come from?
I think it's always been there and didn't have to be padded.
Maybe they propped him up. Put a little pillow underneath.
And so he calls Brian to let him know where he is, which is he's basking in the afterglow after making love outdoors with Dr. David Cameron.
Mm-hmm. No cleanup required.
Apparently not. Brian reveals the accident, even though he says, I'm only going to tell you if you promise not to come back into town and ruin your weekend.
Right. He was very clear on that.
Yes. He makes that point. Yeah. He didn't say anything about it. Like, and he wasn't really hinting at it either. And he reveals the accident. And as soon as they get off the phone, Michael's like, I have to go back.
Are you coming in?
What's up?
I have to go back.
Well, first leading into that call, though, Michael says, made love to David under a tree.
Bask in the afterglow. I loved that. I loved that a lot.
made love.
They did. It
you
was
two,
beautiful.
Stop it. It was beautiful.
It was beautiful.
I thought it was funny that they had the full picnic laid out. You know, there was like a large picnic cloth on the ground.
He literally wined and dined him before pounding him under a tree outside.
All the ants are always around tree. That happened in Pretty Woman. So it's the next day and we are in the Taylor family garage and the Taylor family sedan is completely twisted as if it went through a crusher.
Yes, in which we are able to put together that it was not the angry trick that rammed Brian, yeah. But in fact it was Craig Taylor who committed attempted vehicular manslaughter against.
How did he even drive that car home, though? That thing was completely totaled.
Right, and so you know, Jennifer sees this, and he says some maniac in a Jeep hit him.
My God, what happened to the car?
There's some asshole in a Jeep backed into me.
Justin is leaving, and Craig, tries to stop him from leaving the house, and he's like, "Oh no, I'm not going to be a prisoner."
Yep.
And
Justin finds his security, confidence there.
Yes, he's doing such a great job of standing up to his bigoted father and not taking any of it for a second.
Oh, well, he did say, "You should see me take it like a man." I love that line.
Which of course, Craig immediately slaps him.
And you should see me take it like a man.
Craig!
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. He's baiting him. He's like, "Yeah, you should see me take it."
Gosh, I thought Justin, and this is another kind of fluctuation of Justin's character, he was just surprisingly self-aware and confident with that conversation. And I don't know where he got that from to be that straightforward with his father, who's threatening to send him away, put him onto a plane to go to a boarding school.
Right, where he says, "I think more butt-fucking happens there."
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe... Because we haven't been introduced to Craig until this episode, we don't really know if they've had any type of relationship. So he doesn't feel like he's losing anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I guess I'm not surprised by the way, like, I think now that he's been able to handle it with his mother, he was prepared. Honestly,
yeah,
with his father's reaction.
He'd been working on this for a while, so he had prepared his responses well in advance, and he's also trying to emulate Brian quite a bit. So it does, I guess, come across believable that he has his act together here, and when we get to Brian's loft next, nobody's taking him seriously about it. He reveals that he thinks it was his dad that...
Oh, he knows it was his dad. He puts it together. Like, yeah. He's like, as soon as he says, "What kind of car was it?" He's like, "No, my dad's car was all wrecked up. It had to have been my dad."
"Oh my God, it was my dad. I know it. When I saw his car, it was totally smashed."
Now why would your father do something like that?"
"Because my mom told him everything. He wants to have you arrested and send me away."
"Don't be a drama, princess.
You better be careful."
And they kind of took it seriously and then they didn't, and they were kind of laughing it off. And I think Melanie might have said, "Just be careful." Or I don't think Melanie would say that. Maybe Lindsay said it.
It's probably Lindsay who said it. But no, and like, yeah, as soon as like you could see the conversation getting serious, Brian turns on the music and is just like, "Let's
party
dance."
Time.
They're like, you have a concussion. He's like, he doesn't care. So he just go off and has a dance party in his apartment, which again feeds into the whole theme that we have with Brian throughout this series about mortality.
Yeah.
Even after he could have been even more seriously injured or been, honestly killed in this car wreck.
He barely had a scrape. He had like one Band-Aid on his forehead.
Nevertheless, he's having this party to celebrate. And so like everyone's just dancing, having a good time when Michael and Dr. David Cameron enter, and Michael's like in disbelief.
Yeah. It's almost like Michael wanted to believe that there was something that he needed to save Brian from or to help Brian.
Right.
And when he walks in and you see Emmett doing that really cute dance in the background, you see everybody else dancing and hanging out. And it's not what Michael imagined in his own head it would be, because I don't think reality was at all what Michael thought it was.
Oh, not at all. And, you know, once again, this Dr. David Cameron understands that he is going to constantly play second fiddle to Brian.
Yeah.
And so he leaves. He's done and he's ready to go out. And Mel follows suit and has a really wonderful, like, heart to heart. And I like the fact that there's this connection that Mel has, because she goes through the same thing with Lindsay.
She speaks all access powers.
Right. But
Kane.
She's able to connect with Dr. David Cameron because, much like Michael, Lindsay has some sort of strong emotional connection to Brian that can be in conflict with Mel. So Mel has a heart-to-heart with Dr. David Cameron and feeds him, or gives him, the seed of this idea that we later see at the end of the episode as we all party at Babylon. And, you know, it's as if Michael is back in, like, his comfort zone. He's doing poppers and dancing with Brian.
Well, backing up to Melanie's speech there,
yes.
I had a hard time with this scene because Michael called Brian. Brian showed no intent on interfering with his weekend other than some catty comments when Michael was packing. So how was Brian being manipulative here the way that Melanie's describing? He even specifically told Michael not to come back. There just wasn't enough obstruction here to carry that in story, that storyline through.
She's using past behavior. She knows Brian. And even if he could say that he told him not to come.
So she's leveraging, like, her own.
Oh yeah. She's, like, using her own experience to clock him. And I think,
but what for? I mean, is she out to get him in this case?
Well, it's very well established that she does not like Brian. And I think what she's interested in is making sure that Michael is protected.
But this was all about Michael, and Melanie and Dr. David seem to be putting it all on Brian. And I see Brian as more the innocent party here.
I would disagree with that. I think
he did not tell him to come back. He told him to stay put.
But Mel knows that undoubtedly there has to be some sort of manipulation on Brian's part, because that's his MO.
But there wasn't. There wasn't.
Well, she
here.
Doesn't know that, though. She wasn't there. She wasn't part of the two-way conversation.
Step off, girl.
She can see that Dr. Jerry Cameron has a lot of feelings for Michael, and that Brian's stranglehold on him, and his past manipulative.
So she's talking in the abstract here, absolutely, not the specifics.
And that's why she's able to reinforce Dr. David Cameron to fight for Michael, that he's worth fighting for, even if Brian does in some way remain in the picture. It was basically, she was like saying, show him that you're the alpha.
I just thought it was really sloppy writing, and it was asking a lot of the viewer to be able to make that jump to see this abstract concept when, in fact, it was so tactical and in the moment where they open the door and there's a party going on. But it wasn't Brian's fault.
But remember what he says as Dr. David Cameron leaves. He says, don't go after anyone.
Don't go after him, Mikey. Don't ever go after anyone.
Even still, Michael absolutely should have gone after Dr. David, because it amounts to a misunderstanding. All Michael had to do was say, wow, I, like, really missed this one, and I screwed it up. I'm sorry. But even then, it's like, how early did they come back from the country anyway? This is Sunday afternoon. How much time did they miss?
But again, it was on Brian's call, an observation, to not go after him.
Yeah.
And so Mel stepping in, going, I've been in your shoes before, and this is what I think you need to do.
I mean,
because I'm sure that's what she had to do with Lindsay.
The scene was just a jumbled mess. And
we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one, because I think we could go on another 10, 15 minutes about arguing this one interaction.
Brian's innocent in this case. It was phony drama built up by his, quote, friends.
Meanwhile at Babylon.
Yeah, so Let's Solve Everything by Dr. David Cameron jumping into his club kid clothes.
Which, I mean, I loved this whole scene.
It was ridiculous.
So we have Michael and Brian, they're hitting poppers and they're on the dance floor.
Trail mix.
Enter Dr. David Cameron in sleeveless button-down shirt to make sure his guns are showing.
I think it was flannel, wasn't it?
It was not flannel.
No?
I would have clocked it if it was flannel. It was not flannel. He comes in. He immediately grabs the poppers and or trail mix. And it says there's like another spot on your dance card for me and Michael, of course, assuming he's talking about him. He's like, sure. And he's like, not you, you. And he takes Brian to the dance floor. And the look of devastation on Michael's face.
More phony
for
drama.
Me, priceless.
It was well acted. And I did like how either Emmett or Ted both have their arms around Michael, because they know that something's going down and they saw it was affecting him. But David had the line, for a guy who was on death's doorstep, you made a remarkable recovery. But Brian never played it out that dramatically. He was so matter of fact about it on the phone. And I just don't buy that implied storyline that Brian lured Michael back.
Dr. David Cameron is going off of whatever Michael said. So
And Melanie.
But I think it's all an effort for Dr. David Cameron to really show that
he's a grown
stakes.
Up.
Well, that he also has stakes in this now with Michael.
Yeah.
That he is going, and I love how they do this. He is, I'm trying to remember the sort of complicated way he says it, but he's basically is like, I like him more and want him more than you wanting you making sure that I can't have him.
Yeah, he had a really good speech to Brian there, and that helped to carry the scene that I called a jumbled mess, but
it's so great that they're now in this standoff. I love the fact that Dr. David Cameron's like, I'm staking my claim on this now, and guess what? I'm not gonna go away. And now they're in a standoff, and they're literally just standing still in the middle of the dance floor as the camera fades away.
Yeah, that was really, really well directed there, because Dr. David Cameron and Brian are the only ones not dancing on the entire dance floor, and the music's still going, the lights are flashing, and this pull-away shot really drives home the standoff that you're talking about.
Yeah.
The one hole that I saw in that was Dr. David had this great speech, but these days, I don't think anybody would even do that. They would just simply leave. They would move right on to the next person. I think people that would claim or cling to somebody like Michael in this case are pretty rare. Everybody's like, oh, let me whip out Grindr or Scruff or Jacked and see who's next. So it did further the romantic notion of the scene. But these days, I think most people would be just like, go away, whatever.
I mean, that could be the more cynical view of it. Sure. The romantic in me enjoys the fact that there could still be someone who would want to fight for you.
A chiropractor with a cabin and a Jaguar.
If he's fighting for me, I'm going to be in his corner. At this point, screw Brian. Or actually, no, don't screw Brian. Piss off, Brian. I have a chiropractor, a hot older chiropractor adjusted. Who free adjustments for life. I mean, let's talk about all the positives there would be to locking Dr. David Cameron down. Like, seriously.
So let's wrap this scene up, or this episode up. The question that we like to ask at the end of each episode is, does it hold up? For me, yes, it does. Everything we saw still exists today. There's a couple minor exceptions that were really more props than anything else, like Brian being on AOL and looking at chat rooms. But the themes of jealousy, replacement, change, these are all still parts of modern gay life. And so my vote's yes. It still holds up 17 years later.
I'm going to say that this episode doesn't hold up, and it comes down to a couple of key points for me. One would be the relationship between Justin and his dad, specifically to the coming out process. I feel like it has become a simpler notion for someone to come out as gay or lesbian to their parents, as it becomes part more of the norm in our culture and not so much of the ashamed nature that probably felt 17 years ago. While I do agree that it can be harder to come out as we are discovering the non-gender terms or the transgender terms for someone to come out as gay, with is particularly how Justin's dad handled it. It now seems overblown. Point two would be the notion of the heteronormative relationship that Michael is resisting with him and Dr. David Cameron, especially with the advent of marriage equality and the feeling that it is now wholly possible and within our reach to find someone that we can love, that we can be with, that we can be partners with. The fear of commitment that Michael exhibits with Dr. David Cameron, again, feels very overblown and makes him seem much more immature, especially for someone who's almost 30. I mean, there's not much of an age difference between him and Dr. David Cameron, as much as they try to sell that. So those would be the reasons I'm not sold on this episode holding up.
Okay. So we've got a split decision on this one. I think this is our first split. Next time, we'll be talking about episode 8 of season 1. It's called Babylon Boomerang. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.